Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, a show featuring the people, stories, and events of Central Iowa. I'm one of your hosts for the day, Greta Anderson, and I'm here with Pat Schlarbaum.
Hello, Greta.
And we've got a great show coming up. We've got several live guests coming in and joining us, talking about their areas of expertise. Say later in the show, we're going to actually be joined by a canine friend, as well as the trainer of the dog.
Won't that be fun?
Yes, we can't wait. And then in the middle of the section, we've got some folks who are going to be down at the Iowa State Fair making their pitch to Iowans to pay attention to what's going on with Social Security. But why don't you introduce who has just joined us in the studio right now?
Well, yes, good morning to the listener. This is Pat Schlarbaum, and I'm joined today with Brendan Dunphy.
Good to see you again.
Yeah, here we are. Let's make radio. Brendan's here. He's going to be discussing some of his research that involves mosquitoes here at the university, and we'll touch on some nominal topics that I think the listeners are going to find educational. If not, informative, and also, but there.
I'll tell you everything I know.
Yeah, and I guess there's something about mosquitoes. I mean, we just kind of go to the dark side immediately.
Yeah.
So how is it that you have zeroed in on the mosquito as your area of expertise?
Well, I've always been a zoologist because of a childhood fascination with animals. I moved around the country as a kid, so moving from my birth state of Ohio, where we went to the Cincinnati Zoo all the time, to Washington and down to Baton Rouge, where I was taken to the Baton Rouge Zoo. I don't know if it was those experiences or not, but they really fostered a love for animals at a young age. I remember a conversation with my older brother, who was a big athlete. He was a big sports fanatic. And I said the very uncool thing once whenever they said, what do you want to do when you grow up, or what's your hobby? I guess the question is, what's your hobby? And after hearing a series of footballs and baseballs, I said animals, and I got laughed at. That wasn't the cool answer. But I guess I couldn't help it. You know, all those Discovery Channel documentaries and childhood experiences with animals as a kid just fostered this love for the natural world. Yeah. And always wanted to go to Africa. And it was just overall a life of interest in animals. And when I went to Iowa State, I actually came to be a veterinarian, but decided very quickly I didn't want to be in a clinic for the rest of my life and would rather study animals in their natural habitats, more of an ecologist than anything. And
I guess our early college experiences does kind of winnow out what matters and what doesn't.
That's
so,
right.
So you were drawn to the outdoors, apparently.
Yeah, definitely. You know, there's, you know, I've always had an idealistic goal pursuit, I guess. And I knew that just being in an office all the time was never going to be in the cards for me, whatever that meant. I realized after a while that being a veterinarian was also going to be in an office of a different type for the rest of my life. And I guess I just decided that it was time to be out in the wild. So I undertook studies in ecology, and by the time I graduated from Iowa State with degrees in zoology, animal ecology, and entomology.
And what year was that?
That was 2007, so almost a decade ago now, which I don't like to admit, especially to my students or to my employees. Yeah. But that was about 10 years ago now. And to be honest with you, I started a job in entomology because that's purely where the money was.
Oh, well, okay. there's a practical side to your research.
That's right. You know, I consider myself to still be a zoologist and study animals of all types. In fact, you know, those same Discovery Channel documentaries that influenced me as a kid ended up coming full circle for me, because I ended up, by the time I turned 30, accomplishing my childhood dreams of hosting TV shows for those guys as well. So whether they were Animal Planet or Science Channel or whatever Discovery Networks they might be, hosted a series of television shows and probably have more coming down the pipe. But these days I'm doing books for those guys, acting as invertebrate consultants and insect consultants for Animal Planet and those networks. So
your work here at Iowa State, then let's get into some of your research. what's currently what's going to fill out the rest of your day and the rest of your month?
So I happen to study mosquitoes, which are by all markers and all estimations the deadliest animals to humans because of the fact that they transmit all these disease agents that can cause illness and death in people. Just to name a few, yellow fever, West Nile virus, Zika virus, of course, dengue virus, chikungunya. You know, there's always something new in the news that's being transmitted by mosquitoes. Malaria, yep, yeah. Biggest killer of them all, yep. Yeah. So, at least of mosquito-borne diseases. So the professor that I work for at Iowa State actually has a malaria research program, and he's just in from Johns Hopkins. He came in about a year ago, and he's got some cool, exciting new things.
And what's his
planned.
Name?
His name is Ryan Smith, Dr. Ryan Smith, and you need to get him on this radio show sometime soon.
well, there
he's
you
a
go.
Great interview.
Yeah, he was unavailable for
yeah,
today.
That's right.
We might insert.
So I'll see if I can make things interesting at all.
Well, there you
possible.
Go.
Well, we've got the Olympics, and folks down in Brazil are worried about the sanitary conditions, and as well as the mosquitoes they might encounter on the golf course, for instance.
Yeah, and rightfully so. It's something that they should be and I'm sure were worried about long before the Olympics and before Zika virus as well. Because the tropics just happen to be the area of the globe that has the highest incidence of mosquito-borne disease, and unfortunately the deadliest one. So whether it's malaria or a few of those viruses I mentioned, yellow fever, dengue, they happen to have tropical and subtropical distributions. And a large reason for that is that the mosquitoes that transmit those disease agents only live in those areas. They're adapted to those environments. So, for instance, one common question I get these days is whether or not Zika virus has any threat to the state of Iowa, and the short answer is no. The reason for that is that Aedes aegypti and Aedes albopictus, which are the two primary vectors of that virus, don't really make it this far north. They can't survive the frost line or whatever geographic line you want to draw
there. So there is a specific mosquito that is vectoring virus?
Yes. So one thing that's always good to remind folks is that there are over 3,000 species of mosquito around the world. Keep in mind that mosquito refers to a family, the Culicidae. It's a family of flies, just like there is a family of birds known as the Falconidae, the falcons. There is a family of mammals known as the Suidae, the pigs. Mosquitoes are no different. There are plenty of species. And, again, there's thousands all across the world. Now, we could look at a diverse array of topics as we look across the world and how mosquitoes might have some type of effect on the ecology of those areas. For instance, an interesting nugget is that the highest densities of mosquitoes, do you happen to know where those might be?
Oh, gee, probably where I live in Milford Township. But pretty
you're
good.
You're getting
year.
Closer oh. to the to oh. the unexpected answer because good. The expected answer is the tropics, but it's actually up in the Arctic tundra. Many people don't associate cold biomes and ecotypes with mosquitoes, but keep in mind that even the summers in those areas can get very hot. So what happens is, as the summer melt pools happen during spring and summer melt pools that happen from all the ice and snow over the winter, it hatches gigantic amounts of mosquito eggs that are deposited on the landscape. And also it lures in other mosquitoes to then continue to essentially amplify populations by laying eggs on those waters. So, but that's up in the Arctic tundra. Down in the tropics, we have the highest species diversity. And that's probably largely at play for the reason for a lot of for their role as vectors down in those areas. They also have they can run the gamut for the entire year there because it doesn't ever get to freezing conditions.
And
but
how
in
many,
Iowa, that's different.
And how many separate species would that be offhand?
In the tropics?
In the tropics.
I couldn't give you an answer to that.
Is it tens or hundreds or?
Thousands.
Thousands,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thousands
yeah.
different species,
yeah.
okay.
Yeah, so it would definitely be, so in Iowa, just to put things into perspective for you, in the state of Iowa, there are about 55 species. In the United States of America, there are around 200 species, if my knowledge of the recent species count is still good. Contrast that with the upper hundreds or low thousands down in the tropics. And keep in mind that there's, again, 3,000 species around the world.
And
roughly.
We might be in having new discoveries at any
time?
Oh, yeah,
all the time.
So
all the time.
The science is ongoing. Okay.
You bet. I mean, think about it. They just found a new whale. Is that right? Did they find a new whale species recently? So to find something that's as small as, a gnat or, a small beetle, it's not too unexpected to think of it that
way. So I guess
way.
It takes individuals like yourself.
Yeah, that's
that
right.
That are going to look under every rock, every stone.
Yeah, I guess that's a very good reference to what I do during the day and during the summer because, over the course of 10 years managing the medical entomology lab, you develop a number of different expertises. The first one that I developed, which led to my coming into the lab, was in the realm of mosquito anatomy and identification and taxonomy, keeping track of all the various species, knowing how to identify them. It's something that I had to teach myself to do, to be honest. Before I came, there hadn't really been somebody specializing in that for probably a couple of decades. Mm-hmm. And the situation I came to, and this is by no means talking ill of anything that was going on before me. It's just the reality of the situation. When certain people come and go into a research program, then certain expertises come and go. Mm-hmm. And the situation when I got there was essentially one of undergraduates teaching undergraduates. And by the time it gets down to you, the information is watered down so much mm-hmm. that you kind of have to start from scratch, and I guess I was just one who cared enough about it to start it from scratch in the right way. So I delved back into the Iowa State insect collections and really subjected all the specimens that we collected to the keys that I had and, just really started to figure this stuff out for myself. And I guess that's how I came to oversee the process that was summer mosquito surveillance in Iowa.
Can you explain what you mean by subjected them to the keys that you had? That's quite curious. You unlocked what secrets and how.
Yeah. It's a bunch of magic, actually. So it's just like Harry Potter. You take a wand and you wave it over a petri dish, and then all of a sudden, voila. What you have to do in the world of biology is find some clear and repeatable way to be able to identify specimens that you don't that you don't know the identity of. If you come upon a new mosquito, the question is, what is this? Is this an Aedes aegypti? Is this an Aedes albopictus? Is this a potential vector of Zika virus? Well, you have to figure out first and foremost, what type of mosquito is this? So in the world of biology, we have what are known as dichotomous keys, among other types of keys, that enable you to hone in on identification characteristics that can pinpoint your ID to a given species. And it's all based on anatomy.
So like for trees, it would be, is the leaf smooth or serrated?
That's right.
That's dichotomous.
That's it. And okay. Perfect. So the dichotomy refers to a choice, two different choices that you have to make. And based on whatever series of choices you make about these particular anatomical parts in the key, it will lead you to an identification. So as you would guess, these keys were also constructed by other scientists who have figured these things out themselves, okay? And what the characters that you use in a key are arbitrary. I mean, I could create my own key for the mosquitoes of Iowa, and in fact, in some ways, I have. But mostly by taking from other keys that are already out there. But if, for instance, if a particular investigator were to notice a difference between the seedy, the little bristles on the exoskeleton of a mosquito, and were to find differences in the seedy patterns of these two species, whereas another investigator were more concerned with the differences in the shape of a certain sclerite or exoskeletal segment on the mosquito's thorax, then they might go with that particular character. So it truly is arbitrary. And sometimes you can use two or three of these characters in a given couplet, okay, in a given dichotomy, so to speak. So, for instance, if you're asking the question, is the shape of this sclerite more rectangular or is it more spherical? If the former, then choose A, or point number 2. If it's the latter, then choose point number 3. And by continuing down these numbering systems, you can get further and further into the key, or you can come to an identification pretty immediately. So,
and it's become really apparent how you got your how you were established here at Iowa State and how fortunate we are to have you as a researcher here.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. So the Cica, tell us more about this new species to our wavelength or our understanding. We hear a lot about it.
Yeah, you know, Zika virus is like many other mosquito-borne viruses that have actually been known for decades. The middle 20th century is when we happened to come upon a lot of the encephalitis viruses, for instance, early to mid-1900s, whenever, say, a horse would die down in South America or a man would die in Kenya. And physicians from that era would do some dissection of central nervous system, for instance, and then isolate whatever viruses they could and find out, oh, guess what? We have a new viral sequence and a new virus species, so to speak.
Encephalitis, honing in on the brain?
That's right. Yeah. That's right. Encephalitis, swelling of the meninges or membranes around the brain. There are a number of mosquito-borne viruses that do this. The reason I often use this as a go-to example in looking at the history of mosquito-borne viruses or even their ecology is that my expertise, or at least one of them here in the lab, has been West Nile virus, because that is one that does have an annual occurrence in the state of Iowa, and it is now endemic here. We have it, if you remember, it arrived here 15 years ago, and it's here to stay. The vectors, the mosquitoes that transmit it, are very common in the state of Iowa and around the country, and have plenty of reservoir hosts, which are the hosts that are needed to propagate this in nature, and those are birds, okay?
Yeah, and some of those I can relate. It's been quite a killer.
Yeah, you're an ornithologist, Pat.
Well, they sure are hard on the birds. And one thing that that we've seen, the ospreys, for instance, that we previously would ban in July or a couple weeks ago during the high-stress era of the summer, and it seemed like that West Nile virus then, it was subjecting them to that sort of calamity.
Do you see death in birds
yes, we presume
is West Nile?
Yeah, especially the corvids, the crows and those type of birds, but also a lot of the raptors. And as it was coming across the continent when it hit Ohio and Indiana and then Illinois, and they kind of alerted us. Saying,
yeah, this is probably a big story for you 15 years ago.
You've got something. Yeah, 15 years ago. It was you got something coming that's really going to impact a lot of your raptors that you've worked pretty diligently in recovering. But thankfully, the survivors have been able to adapt. What are you treating mosquitoes with currently?
So on the science side of things at Iowa State, we actually do not deal anything with mosquito control in the city of Ames. So our surveillance program deals with, and I realize I didn't answer any Zika questions yet. We can circle back around to that whenever you want to.
Yeah.
Sorry, there's so many tangents we could go on here.
So many
mosquitoes out there, and they certainly have skyrocketed in certain places in Iowa here the last few weeks because of all the rain. Yeah. And based on last night's, my life could be hell on earth here in about 2 weeks. We'll see.
And so that's the time frame.
Okay.
Standing water.
Yeah, that's right. So I mean, there still would be some standing water remaining in certain shaded areas underneath forest canopies from all the rain we've had recently. But last night was a rain that will definitely hatch a significant number of floodwater mosquitoes.
Oh, okay. Sorry to hear that. But I guess we know this drill.
Yeah, it's a drill that we're hit hard with every summer in Iowa, right?
Well, I would like to have you come back and talk about any sort of control or what you recommend, because with the West Nile virus, there was discussion of starting out with DDT again, and of course that was a killer of. It was to rid the world of malaria, and it was killing the planet, and it was banned in 1972. And surprisingly, it still comes up. And the other day, because of the Zika concerns in Florida, they'd like to start spraying DDT again.
Well, this is an interesting conversation, because ultimately it's a battle of philosophies. It's a battle of values and priorities. On the one hand, we can look at the use of DDT as bad for the environment as a bioaccumulator.
As a bioaccumulator, a little bit in each insect, then as the predator or the animal is eating it, it bioaccumulates. And pretty soon you have too much.
Just like mercury in sea fishes, for instance. Okay. Yep. In the food chain or the food web, so to speak, the trophic web, the more things that are eating the smaller things, the more the compounds that are in the smaller things accumulate in the larger ones. So You know, the use of DDT in Africa as a means of reducing malaria was actually a successful tactic. And that's why it is such a sexy idea, especially in a modern day when Zika is such a buzzword and the incidence has increased to a point of, you know, of alarm. It becomes a relevant discussion again. Okay, should we use DDT to get rid of, you know, Zika incidents or to reduce transmission? And ultimately, again, this is just a matter of opinion. And frankly, I don't have one. You know, frankly, we're still at the early stages of knowing what Zika is going to do in the Americas and what effect it truly does have on people. I think the linkages between a lot of the human symptoms and more severe symptoms like microcephaly are being solidified over the last year. In 2015, we were dealing with a lot of uncertainty, and even into the winter and spring of this year.
And fear.
Yeah, dealing with a lot of uncertainty and fear. But let's face it, the American public and the world, for that matter, always needs a new disease to be freaking out about. And this is the current one. Mm-hmm. And that's certainly not to undermine the importance of this disease in areas where it is causing tragedy and causing illness. Mm-hmm. But there are a lot more unanswered questions than answered questions right now, and we, even scientists for that matter, can often jump to conclusions about what's going on before actually studying its ecology and figuring out what is going on, and studying the medical implications as well, and figuring out how much of a linkage there is between these infections and a lot of these symptoms. And if it's continued to solidify over the next year or two, then at least it shows that we were right in being concerned about it. Mm-hmm. But I gotta say, with West Nile virus as an example, and being, you know, my expertise and seeing how the interest in that has faded over the last 15 years, these things can often be a concern because of the fact that they're new, right? It's the honeymoon stage of the virus. We're all new to it, and it's a new name, and it even sounds freaky, Zika. So all of a sudden, the media starts amplifying it in a way before it perhaps should so far, you know, and that's why people shouldn't be worried about it in Iowa is that, again, we don't really have any vector species here, but there will still be people that call me occasionally and say, I think I found a Zika virus vector in my backyard. Will you identify this for me? But the truth is people don't have anything to worry about.
Well, Brian Dunphy, we're very pleased that you're on the researcher's track here at Iowa State, and you're going to be delving into these ponderous works of how to keep us safe from these mosquitoes that everybody kind of derides, but yet they're not going away. So let's have you come back when the Zika story unfolds even further.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And pulls up into the driveway. And old story doesn't fold. She's standing by the road in Denver, where the roses are in bloom, looking at the Atlantic Ocean. And in her head she hums this tune. Thank God the dark nights are drawn in again. Ah, summer's got me down. Come to wait till the end of August. I get off this merry-go-round.
And that's High Summer by Van Morrison, a new song by him. And it is High Summer right now. And one of the features of High Summer is that the Iowa State Fair gets going. Yesterday was the first day of the Iowa State Fair. And we have in our midst now a couple people who are running a campaign at the Varied Industries Building at the Iowa State Fair to inform the Iowa public about Social Security and where Social Security is going. Let's welcome Sue Olson and Rob Bingham. They are involved in this campaign called Take a Stand.
Well, thank you very much for having us.
Greta, good morning. Sue Olson. I work with Rob with Take a Stand, and currently I am the volunteer leader in Iowa's 4th Congressional District. So we're out in cities like Ames, Mason City, Fort Dodge, Spencer, telling people and working with our volunteers about Take a Stand for Social Security.
Okay. And Rob has been actually down at the fair already yesterday.
Yeah, we were down there. I was there from 2 to 7 down in our booth. In the Varied Industries Building, right if you go in the gate, I think it's gate 11, and you keep walking down that entrance, we were right around the corner. You can't miss us. But a big red Take a Stand sign up in front.
Okay, and tell me, tell our audience what you are saying to people as they come up to your table and say, take a stand. Take a stand about what?
Take a stand. Well, Social Security, it's a very important issue across the country and moreover here in the state of Iowa. We are working with trying to get our members as well as people stopping by the booth to sign pledge cards or in petitions to make sure that we can get as much information from our presidential candidates as possible. The goal of Take a Stand this year more than ever is, since AARP is nonpartisan and we don't really have a PAC or we don't really support any particular candidate, is to get as much information and details from various presidential candidates, in this case now Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, so that we can best provide the information back to our members and the American public as a whole, so that we can inform them about, you know, how best to update Social Security for the 21st century.
And what we specifically want them to tell us is, what is your plan to strengthen Social Security? How is it going to affect our families? What's it going to cost us? And how are you going to get it done? So that's specifically what we're asking them to give us the details about.
Okay, now we've heard, all the way back to, I remember Al Gore talking about the black box or lockbox of Social Security. And so Social Security and its financial solvency has been an issue for a long time. What is it right now that is the main thrust of this campaign?
Mm-hmm. AARP has been working on Social Security, I think, for almost 60 years. And right now, the pressure is that the Social Security Administration trustees have told us that if nothing is done to shore up Social Security by 2034, by law right now, there's going to be a 25% cut in benefits for everyone receiving Social Security. So right here in Iowa, what we know is that beneficiaries today are receiving an average of $1,300 a month here in Iowa. $15,600 a year. So you can see that with the cost of living right now, that money just doesn't go very far. So we have to do whatever we can to prevent this from being cut. So that's the urgency right now. It's 18 years from now. That sounds like a long time from now, but as slowly as things grind in D.C., you can understand why we have to start now in that process, and we have to have presidential leadership to get that done.
Yeah, doing nothing really is not an option at this point. Talking points really can only go so far. We need to have actual concrete details from our next president, mm-hmm. as well as a commitment from our congressional leaders in order to best prevent this catastrophe really from happening in 2034.
Yeah, I was going to say every 2 years there are congressional campaigns, so mm-hmm. surely that must also be a focus as well as the presidential candidates.
We're urging our presidential candidates to outline specific details. And the reality of this political climate, it's the presidential candidates who set forth the agendas, the parties that set forth the agendas. But we actually need a commitment from a Congress. So here in the 4th District, we have Kim Weaver and we have Steve King. We're reaching out to both sides of the aisle, since we're nonpartisan, to best get their commitment saying, if elected, you will do something about this.
And what we really want our congressional folks to tell us is, no matter who's elected as our president, will you support that person's plan to strengthen Social Security? And will you work with them in the Congress in 2017 to get the Social Security debate in front of them at the beginning of the year? Will you commit to doing that? So that's our ask of them.
That's very important, that bipartisan cooperation to get something meaningful done.
Exactly. I mean, Social Security is an issue that spans generations. It's an issue that spans political ideologies. I was actually at the Trump event last week, and I ran into this really nice old lady, and she said, you know, I am an ardent Republican, and I think Social Security is an issue that, not just for me, but for my kids and my grandkids, that's something that needs to be taken care of. And just Wednesday, we went to a Hillary event, and we ran into a lot of people who felt the exact same way. This is an issue that affects everybody. It doesn't matter if you're Republican, Democrat, Libertarian, Green Party. It's an issue that affects us all.
And it's so important to stress that it affects so many generations, certainly the people that are retired right now, but our kids and grandkids coming up, because we all pay out of our paychecks for Social Security. Mm-hmm. We've earned those benefits, and we deserve to have them, and we deserve to know how our leaders are going to strengthen the plan so it's there for future generations.
Do you bristle, Sue, when you hear the entitlement term when referring to Social Security?
Well, there's a lot of discussion around that issue, isn't there? For me personally, I don't feel that way. I feel that it's a well-earned benefit. I've paid for that benefit my entire life. I'm retired now. So it's important to me that I have it, but I'm not offended by that. I personally feel so strongly that I've earned those benefits, as do the generations coming up behind me. We're all paying for that benefit. So I'm not offended by that. I really don't pay much attention to that word.
Okay.
It's interesting that, you know, entitlement is, it's not automatically suggesting that you're asking for something that you haven't earned, but it's kind of earned that connotation.
Somehow or another, it's like baggage. To a program that was when it was initiated in the 1930s, I believe. And there was a time that the social fabric of America needed strengthening, that people needed a safety net, and they started contributing. It wasn't designed to be your complete retirement package, if you will, but again, a safety net to at least give people some financial support in their retirement years.
And I think one reason it's so important right now is that it is the only guaranteed retirement benefit. And along the way, you know, some people say, hey, boomers haven't saved so much. Well, perhaps we haven't saved as much as we should have, but there are other huge factors as well. Pensions that our parents and grandparents might have had have gone away. We don't have a lot of pensions today. We have children that have moved back home. We're supporting them. We've paid their colleges. I mean, there's a lot of reasons why this is so important, but it is the only guaranteed form of a benefit right now.
I want to ask Rob. Rob, you are not in the boomer generation.
I am not. I am 20 years old. I'm a millennial. That's, I think that's what we're calling ourselves these days.
So I've got to ask, what draws you to this struggle? You're volunteering your time and energy.
Yeah, well, part of it is when I go and I have my paycheck, I see this little FICA. It's taken out. And I always wondered what it was, and I talked to my parents. And they explained to me that this is your Social Security, and they explained the program to me. It's a really important program that, I mean, everybody will eventually have to, hopefully not, but they will eventually have to deal with. But this, moreover, this year more than any, is I'm joining this program because my grandparents, they're living over in the northern suburbs of Chicago. They just moved into this really, really nice retirement home. And the issue is with his pension as well as his Social Security, he really doesn't have enough to pay for just that. And they're going to most likely have to move back in with my aunt and uncle, who live about 30 minutes away. And I feel bad because he has done everything in his life to make sure that he and his wife and their kids, my mom, are felt comfortable. And the fact is that it's an issue that affects us all, not just my grandparents, but then they're having to move back in with my aunt and uncle. And it has repercussions down the chain. So it's not just our current generation of retirees. It's the next generation and the generation after that. And it's an issue that most likely, if I have kids down the road, they're going to have to deal with as well.
Well, Sue, I'm sure you agree with me that we are our society is so much better to have young people who are not only paying into Social Security, but who are being engaged in the community, like Rob, in issues that matter to us all and are farsighted enough to see that we are all connected.
It takes all generations to work on this. And I think one point I also want to make about people that are retired today, many people have retired only to take up new careers. And they're still working. They're working full-time or they're working part-time, much beyond the retirement age that we think of. And the importance of that is they're still working and they're still paying into Social Security, even though they may be receiving a benefit, they're still working. If you're over your full retirement age, you can work and receive Social Security benefits. So some of us are still working, we're paying taxes, we're spending our money in the communities. So those are important things to keep in mind as well.
Okay, well, thank you so much for joining us today and explaining this crisis that we face.
Yeah, definitely. I also wanted to mention today, the 12th, this Friday, we're going to be having a Big Ten event right outside the Elwell Family Food Center. It's currently going on now all the way through 9 o'clock, so please stop by. We have prizes, fun activities, and a lot of information.
Okay, great. Well, let's get this change happening, and thanks for coming in.
Well, thank you, Greta, for having us.
Thank you so much for having us.
wasn't scared of jumping off the truck in high gear. King went a sniffing and he would go. Was the best old hound dog I ever did know. I had a dog and his name was King. I told the dog about everything. There in my truck, the dog and I. Then one day the King up and thought about the times we had. Once when I kicked him when he was fat. Old King sure meant a lot to me, but that hound dog is history. King went running after deer. Wasn't scared of jumping off the truck and high. Sniffing and he would go. Was the best old hound dog I ever did know. That old King was a friend of mine. Never knew a dog that was half as fine.
And that is Neil Young with his song King, about a beloved hound dog. Many of us have beloved dogs in our lives, and our next guest certainly does. He is Jim Peters, a local dog trainer who has done work with detection dogs. And yeah. I believe that one of them has joined us right now.
Yeah, hi, Rocky. You know, live radio provides us many opportunities. It's not often we have a beautiful German Shepherd that's joined us now. We do what we can to enliven the studio, and I think this might be a first. He's finding his place.
But he's lost his ball.
Yeah. Oh, the ball, oh, it went under the couch. Yeah, as it always goes. Well, I might give some background. I met Mr. Peters as we were discussing using his dogs for detecting Blanding's turtles over at Dewey's Pasture in Greene County.
Turtles?
Yeah, yeah. And that's just one of the sidelights. But welcome, Jim Peters.
Good morning. Pleasure to be here.
So let's talk about how you got involved with dog training, and then some of your activities here in the Story County area.
I've been involved in search and rescue since the early 90s, pardon me, and got involved with search and rescue dogs around 2000. Always had a dog around growing up, often more than one dog out on the farm.
Uh-huh.
And I've been captivated by their behavior more than anything. Certainly they're great companions, but it's fascinating to me the things that they appear to know and the things that they do. For example, my home office is on the second floor of our house, and the dogs will nap in the hallway. But with the windows closed and the air conditioner on, they can tell when a neighbor is walking another dog down the street in front of the house.
Oh. Uh-huh.
How do they do that? Don't know. I'm sure all dogs do that. But it's...
Well, you know, and along those lines, I've had dogs that didn't really know me that well, but new dogs to my area. And as I would turn the corner to drive to the lane where I live, they would become alert, as if they were reading something telepathically that I was close to home. Oh, maybe this is the new home. It just seemed like that they register in ways that are fascinating.
Right.
So your interest, you grew up having dogs, and you've just sort of specialized, or you've taken this to the next level, if you will, with your search. And
yeah, in the last few years, well, my first search and rescue dog timed out about 2010, and then this particular dog showed up at a meeting when he was a puppy with his litter mates, and he was available. He was the only one there that was interested in people and toys. And
is that a good trait, I guess?
Yeah, oh, yeah.
It would seem to be,
yeah. Yeah, we like to have them be social, and because they're not police dogs. And even police dogs are generally pretty social, depending on the situation. Yeah. But we like to have them be social. and that ball drive is the foundation of everything else that you do with the
dog. Is that the reward? Then
they work for the dopamine release. They want to be happy. They want to be excited.
That's fascinating. Dopamine in our brains, or in their brains?
The pleasure receptors.
Yeah. I see. Yeah. Okay.
And in our evaluation of a new dog, we'll see how many times they chase the ball. We'll throw the ball into tall grass to see if they'll go after it, how long they'll hunt for it. We'll use things like plastic water bottles and a variety of other objects to see if they'll play with it. Just to assess what their drive is like. And the higher the drive, the easier they are to train. But that also makes them more challenging to live with, to have in the house, because they always have to be doing something like Rocky right now, chewing on a ball on the floor.
That's the noise that our listeners may hear in the background.
Yeah.
A noisy rubber ball.
Yeah. Live radio, we're joined with one of your search and rescue dogs. And how old is Rocky?
Rocky just turned 4, and Rocky specializes in looking for missing persons, either alive or deceased. He does what's known as trailing, where if I had your pencil or your headset and he could scent that, then he would follow your scent on the ground until he found you.
Are there breeds that are more trainable, or what would be the term there? Have a propensity to.
We tend to look at the working dog breeds. They seem to be wired to interact with humans. Dogs with longer noses do better than dogs with short noses because of the volume of olfactory receptors in their noses. And certainly the durability of the dog. Chihuahuas are great little dogs, but they're not going to be much good out in the field. However, they might make the right Chihuahua, might make a good pest control dog to look for termites or something like that inside a dwelling.
Or the bed bug.
Or the bed bug, yeah.
Yeah. So the bed bug situation is a new area for you?
I'm not doing that. There are others doing that. That's been around for maybe 10-ish years. The USDA has been using beagles at the Miami airport since the 90s to search for contraband organic produce, things that people try to bring into the country.
They may have insects and that are connected with their fruit. Let's kind of talk about some of the work that I know you're involved with here in Story County, Boone County, with the Pioneer Cemeteries. I was able to witness one of your activities over around a Pioneer Cemetery along the Des Moines River. Tell us about training a dog to locate pioneer
gravesites. Well, what we've discovered is that as humans decompose in the ground, as their body structure changes and breaks down chemically, volatile organic compounds, or VOCs, are released. And there's been research on those VOCs, and researchers have identified almost 500 different compounds. They don't know which ones specifically the dogs are detecting, but we do know that they can still find them after 100 years or 200 years or even longer. We've worked on some native burials that were over 500 years old.
So once those compounds are in the soil, and I also was able to see the dogs kind of looking up around the trees, they would be alert to something on the ground, and then all of a sudden they were looking up.
So it's simple chemistry. Those VOCs are released into the soil. Many of them will bind to the various chemicals in the soil, and plants with root systems like trees or bushes, for example, will pull up that subsoil moisture that contains those VOCs.
The volatile organic compounds.
And it's pretty classic to see a dog on a more current grave, say a clandestine grave out in the woods, or on a historic grave, if there's a larger tree in the area, look up that tree in their efforts to locate the source of that scent.
You know, and just a little sidelight, I know the grizzly bears, they're out in Alaska and places in, that are after the salmon, and they drag the salmon away from the river, and it's my understanding the Douglas fir then will assimilate, basically use the salmon as fertilizer.
Oh, sure, yeah.
And then and they can find these volatile organic compounds in the tree. And so,
sure.
So that it's kind of like a direct link to the river, removed from the river, and it takes those grizzly bears to get that fish from you know, the waterway, 100 yards, 200 yards.
And I've never seen any scientific research. It's probably out there, but grizzly bears and bears in general are known for having superior olfactory senses. Mm-hmm. They may be more superior than canines.
They may be. Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, so...
You can see the value of having a dog that would know, you know, in terms of detection and the associations with police work, of having a dog who could find an underground body, you know, a buried body.
Right. Yeah, we've done some cold case investigations over the last year and a half as a part of our business. We've also worked with archaeologists on some historic grave projects, and the dog in those instances is not the final determination. They do a variety of activities to determine if there are historic burials present. And the dog is just one more layer of confidence. It lets them know that there may be a human decomp in the area. And then we're also doing some work with invasive plants. We just wrapped up a project with the Iowa DNR looking for Blanding's turtles in Greene County. And so pretty much anything that has its own unique scent picture, we can condition a dog to look for it. And we're not training the dogs. They already know how to use their noses. We're just doing operant conditioning right out of psychology class. They exhibit a certain behavior, and we give them a reward.
Yeah, and the Blanding's turtles, they're essentially not an aquatic. They spend some time in the water bodies, but they're over land. So
correct.
That's where you were hoping to detect some
yes.
of their presence, and I might include that you're going to be woven into some wood turtle surveys up on the Wapsipinicon River here in Iowa. And, of course, a dog could be so much more efficient at locating these struggling turtles going through the prairie. And, you know, you could walk right by them. You won't know they're there. But
they're very
the dogs
difficult.
Are detecting them.
Right. They're very difficult to see if they get down into the grass. And in the search and rescue world, if under the right conditions, depends on the vegetation and the wind and the humidity, under the right conditions, a dog can clear an acre in much less than 10 minutes.
Mm-hmm. Does it have a kind of pattern of weaving back and forth across the landscape? Is that part of what you teach
yes.
it?
Yes, yes. Well, actually, they do that on their own.
Really?
We give them verbal cues and then send them out, and if they get into scent, then they will start gritting back and forth
really?
To find the source of the scent.
That's so interesting, because you think of the grid as kind of a human overlay, you know, that onto a landscape, and that the dog is innately using that kind of 90-degree angle system is kind of interesting.
Yes. Well, we call it the working the negative. Sometimes if there's a scent source and a good breeze, there will be kind of a plume of scent coming from that scent source, and the dog may work from side to side to try to find the edges of that scent in an effort to find the source.
Can you tell me a little bit more, Pat, maybe about the turtles that you
The research?
Yeah, what is that all about?
Well, you know, anytime we have to determine the population status of these wood turtles are endangered, so... you kind of got to come up with some numbers or some sort of means of determining what is out there on the landscape. So it's another strategy to achieve detection, either presence or absence in certain areas. And we're going to go to what we would consider wood turtle rich environment, where there's some study going on, but with transmitters and locations and things. So from that, we're hoping to extrapolate population levels or just how, and then you can have a trend. You know, once you get that baseline data, then 5 years, 10 years, where are we at? And it's an area of research that we need more of. So,
okay. And then I wanted to ask also about the invasive species. You mentioned invasive species. Obviously, these turtles are not invasive. They're native and they're endangered. What sort of invasive species are you after?
Invasive weeds. We did a project this spring looking for garlic mustard, which is very problematic in wooded areas as it takes over the ground and pretty much smothers other plant growth, and it will even prohibit new trees from coming up in an area. And the practice is to find the invasive species early so that they can be eradicated and then go back in following years to assure that they're 100% cleared.
Okay. Well, we're out of time, but before we go, Jim Peters, I just want to ask you about the name of your company, Samaritan Detection Dogs.
My partner is a police officer who's near retirement. I was a paramedic for a terribly long time. Mm-hmm. And we've worked in the public safety, public service world for most of our adult lives, and the dogs have the ability to help humans do a number of things. We tend to put a lot of energy into missing person situations. And even if the missing subject is deceased, the family still finds great comfort in having them located and having their remains returned to them. And, mm-hmm. and so I suppose that's the Samaritan aspect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and God bless you for that.
Oh, thank you.
Well, Jim Peters, thank you so much. You're a part of our community, and what a fascinating contribution you make to all humanity.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I've been your host, Greta Anderson, together with Pat Schlarbaum. We started off the show with Brendan Dunphy of Iowa State University talking about mosquitoes, and then turned to Sue Olson and Rob Bingham, two activists who are involved in the Take a Stand campaign to shore up Social Security. Finally, Jim Peters joined us with his wonderful dog, Rocky, who's now asking Jim to play with him.
Yes, so. he's ready to go.
Let's get a picture of Rocky for the website.
You betcha. And Local Talk will be rebroadcast at noon and 7 p.m. You can listen to today's Local Talk show and any of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org. There you'll also find information about our guests along with relevant links to today's stories. And you can like us on Facebook and get updates of all our show postings in your news feed. Thanks to Ron Carson for making that possible.
Local Talk was engineered by Jonah DeGeese. Our theme song is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other music you heard were
Van Morrison with High Summer and Neil Young with Old King.
Yeah. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a show. If you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 292-2878. That's 292-2878. Or contact us through our website, khoifm.org. And if this is the birthday weekend, let's invite everybody down for birthday activities.
That's
tomorrow, Saturday morning, 8:30.
Live music starting at 3. Basketball book sale starting at noon or even a little earlier if you want to sneak in and get the best picks.
Mm-hmm.
If you enjoyed this show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Thanks for listening, and see you again on the radio.
Funding for KHOI is made possible in part by the Ames Chamber of Commerce. In the heart of Ames, the Ames Main Street Farmers Market brings local food and fun. Located between the 300 and 400 blocks of Main Street, including Tom Evans Plaza, the Farmers Market provides fresh local fruits, veggies, meats, breads, handcrafted goods, live music, and family entertainment every Saturday.